Yachts, parks, and the Tsleil-Waututh Nation.
Aboriginal history here goes back at least 9,000 years if you're looking at the archaeological data, or time immemorial according to the First Nations that you talk to.
A conversation with Jonathan Clapperton about the history of Desolation Sound Marine Park in British Columbia. And I sit down with participants from a recent symposium at the University of Saskatchewan on the historical significance of local and regional parks. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to Episode 18 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. The provincial government of British Columbia describes Desolation Sound Marine Provincial Park as a yachter's paradise, located at the confluence of the Malaspina Inlet and Humphrey Channel, just north of the town of Powell River, British Columbia. The calm, warm waters of Desolation Sound are a popular destination for boating tourists, swimmers, and scuba divers. Most visitors to this marine provincial park, however, are largely unaware of the interconnections between this park, the province's history of colonization, and the displacement of the region's Aboriginal population. The park itself is over 8,400 hectares in size and encompasses the traditional territories of a number of different Aboriginal nations from coastal British Columbia, including the local Tsleil-Waututh Nation. Since none of this area of the province was ever ceded to the Canadian government through a treaty agreement, the relations between Aboriginal people and BC parks have been troubled since the creation of this park in the 1970s. As part of his doctoral research on the historical relations between North American Aboriginal peoples and non-Aboriginal environmentalists, John Clapperton joined us on this podcast to tell us more about the history of Desolation Sound.
Hi, my name is John Clapperton, and I'm at the University of Saskatchewan working with Keith Carlson.
John, thanks for joining us today. I wanted to ask you, where is Desolation Sound, and how did it become a marine provincial park?
Yeah, that's a great question, and thanks for having me here. Desolation Sound is really close. The nearest town is Lund, which most people probably won't know about, and it's also close to Powell River on BC's Sunshine Coast. It's actually only about 90 miles north of Vancouver, so it's not actually that far, but it's fairly isolated, sort of as its name suggests, since you need to take ferries to get there, and then to get to the Desolation Sound itself, you actually have to go by boat or by plane. There's no roads going into the area. It's a really gorgeous place. It's really characterized by its warm waters in the summer. It's got extremely deep waters, and so this is why a lot of yachters and other people like to go there. Kayakers also like to go here as well. So it's a really beautiful place, sort of contrary to what its name is.
Mm.
And it became a park pretty much for these reasons. It's really linked to its ideal location for yachters. Yachters start coming here in the 1920s as part of more of this broader movement for people to get outdoors and get away from the cities. These sort of back to the land movements to get outside and get away from industrial modernity. And so in the 1920s, these yachters start sailing here from the United States and from other places as well, but mostly from the United States and a little bit from Canada. And so they start promoting this area, Desolation Sound, and sort of a yachter's paradise. And so word kind of spreads and it gets a little bit more popular. And then eventually these yachters start sort of pushing for the British Columbia government to protect it, to protect this area from development and from privatization. One of the main industries here is logging. Powell River is sort of one of the biggest pulp and paper mills in the world at this time, around the 1950s and the 1960s. So these yachters are really worried that their area will get logged and get developed and things like this. So at the same time, in the 1960s and sort of into the early 1970s, there's also a local conservation movement that starts to sort of spur in Powell River as well. So there's kind of locals that want to protect this area as well, sort of as a place that's near enough to them that they can go as well and experience outdoors and experience the wilderness, is what they would call it. And then coinciding with that as well, British Columbia's system of parks is expanding. So sort of the precursor to what's known today as BC Parks is starting to pop-up parks all around the province. And they go to Desolation Sound. They're getting letters, and they check it out. And essentially, they see that it's a great place. It has great park potential. And they actually believe they could make money from developing this as apart from developing infrastructure and things like that. There was originally plans they had designed about making the area accessible by road and things like this, although none of that went through.
So it was admired both for its marine environment, for, I guess, aquatic recreation, as well as the sort of surrounding coastal landscape?
Exactly, yeah. Just a really gorgeous spot. So people wanted to go there and enjoy it.
So
really marked by, its deep waters and then little islands everywhere and things like that.
This park has a really interesting name. Can you tell us a little bit about how Desolation Sound got its name?
Sure, yeah. It's actually quite an old name. Captain George Vancouver, when he was touring off the coast of what would become British Columbia back in 1792, came upon the place, and he didn't like it at all. He thought it was quite abandoned. He didn't see any sort of Aboriginal settlements, and the ones that he did see were what he thought were abandoned. Some of them were, but some of them were just sort of temporarily abandoned as people were out on the landscape rather than on their coastal villages. So in any event, he thought it was kind of a useless landscape, and so we ended up calling it Desolation Sound to reflect that. Of course, people today disagree with his appraisal, although they still think it's sort of an abandoned landscape as well.
And now that's really the point of your research here, is that Desolation Sound isn't desolate and never has been desolate. It's a region that has an obvious Aboriginal history that predates European resettlement and one that persists into the present. So how did the local Tsleil-Waututh Nation react to the creation of this provincial park and the framing of this space as being desolate?
Right, yeah, and that's a great question. And that's a great point to make, that Aboriginal history here goes back at least 9,000 years, if you're looking at the archaeological data, or time immemorial, according to the First Nations that you talk to. I should also point out, too, that Desolation Sound isn't just the traditional territory of the Tsleil-Waututh or the Tsleil-Waututh First Nation, but it also overlaps with the Clahoose and the Homalco First Nations as well.
Mm-hmm.
My study is just focusing on the Tsleil-Waututh, though, just in order to get that deep ethnohistory that you can. But anyways, the reaction of the Tsleil-Waututh to the creation of this provincial park, and I should mention that it was created in 1973,
right,
is when Desolation Sound Marine Park is created. And then shortly thereafter, there's other what they call satellite parks created throughout the area as well that are quite smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, from what I've learned through local community oral histories and also through the archival record, is that the Tsleil-Waututh and the Clahoose and the Homalco aren't consulted at all about the parks. The Tsleil-Waututh particularly had been restricted to reserves back in 1879. They were restricted to 6 small reserves. And so the government saw these places as really open and unclaimed. There were some non-native settlers in there as well, but not very many in the Desolation Sound Marine Park area. So the reaction by the Tsleil-Waututh is really not much of a reaction at all. There wasn't really any organized movement against the park. It was sort of done without talking to them anyways, so they weren't too familiar with what was going on. And so that sense, it wasn't really opposed in that way. But it was eventually opposed as sort of part of the broader process of colonialism that British Columbia continued to do. Of course, in British Columbia, there's very few treaties signed at this time. There's only some signed on Vancouver Island. And so the Tsleil-Waututh just see sort of this park designation. It's just kind of a continuation of the colonial process of kind of remapping space that they had never given up anyway. So it was just more of the same going on.
So this is fascinating to see in the case of a provincial park, because there's certainly an established literature and environmental history on the role of national parks as mechanisms of colonialism for capturing Aboriginal territory and transferring that over to the federal state. But here you're arguing that the provincial state in British Columbia performs a similar function through its provincial park system in the 1970s.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of my main points, is that it's not just the federal government. One of my sort of broader points in my dissertation, that it's not just the federal government that's using parks as kind of a means of land capture, but it's also provincial governments too, and then as well as municipal governments. So there's multiple layers of sort of parks being used as a way to redesignate land that's contested.
Can you talk a little bit about the contemporary relevance of provincial parks in British Columbia and the land question and the treaty-making process that's ongoing?
Sure, yeah. I mean, British Columbia is really renowned, I think, worldwide for its park system. It's incredibly large. There's over 12% of the whole province is provincial park, in addition to the national parks that are sort of dotted throughout there as well. So it's kind of something that I think all British Columbians kind of coalesce around, their identity can coalesce around this. When the treaty process emerged, when the provincial government finally agreed to negotiate treaties with the First Nations in the early 1990s, there was quite a worry that First Nations would ask for these park spaces. Mm-hmm. So the general public worried that these parks would be lost because they weren't logged or they weren't developed or things like this. They were sort of prime locations that First Nations might want. And so there's actually sort of an outcry against First Nations for maybe asking for these places, even though none of them had up to that point. The treaty process was just kind of in its early stages. So what the British Columbia government did in order to kind of appease its constituents, I guess, and that also in order to maintain its own sort of dominance over these spaces, is in 1995 it passed a bill removing all parks, all provincial parks, from the treaty table. So there's no option for First Nations, including the Tsleil-Waututh, to ever get back this territory. It's essentially taken out of their hands forever.
This is a really fascinating case study that you provide on Desolation Sound, in part, I guess, because this park is created in the 1970s at around the same time that, for instance, the Crying Indian commercial is being broadcast in the United States, sort of emblematic of this perception of Aboriginal people being natural stewards of the environment. And yet you describe in a lot of ways how parks, as part of an environmental movement, ended up circumscribing Aboriginal uses of nature in the case of Desolation Sound. Can you talk a little bit about how the Tsleil-Waututh Nation's use of natural resources in Desolation Sound was circumscribed by park creation?
Right, and that's a great point to raise about the whole ecological Indian that Shepherd Kretsch and other people have been talking about. My dissertation's really looking at that contradiction. On one hand, holding Aboriginal people up as sort of the natural stewards of the earth, and on the other hand, in places like Desolation Sound, removing them from being able to use that space and sort of denying them the opportunity. In Desolation Sound, in particular, and within the Tsleil-Waututh First Nations area generally, they've really been restricted in a lot of ways in what they can do, and really important ways that they're quite upset about. So in the past, for example, not in the recent past, but sort of shortly after the park was created, park rangers would stop Tsleil-Waututh on occasion for gathering or fishing within the park. They've also been disturbed and challenged by outsiders right up into the present for visiting the park and for extracting the natural resources there, doing things like bark stripping or fishing or gapping fish in rivers and things like this. Tourists see this as sort of damaging the park, damaging the park's integrity, and they see it as a use that's unconventional, that should be stopped. And so some Tsleil-Waututh have actually told me they've even been threatened when they encounter tourists while they're doing this. And so some of them have just simply stopped going to the park. They see it as kind of an unwelcoming space where they can't do what they believe is sort of the right thing to do there or the appropriate thing to do there.
And so you found evidence of this continuing into the present, even after it's been established that the Tsleil-Waututh Nation has a right to harvest natural resources from the park?
Yeah, yeah, it still goes on. First Nations, under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, are allowed to continue their traditional activities within parks, including national parks. And they're also, under BC Parks Act in BC, allowed to continue their traditional activities. But there exists this sort of popular ideology of parks as pristine and as spaces where you can't extract any sort of resource. And so when people see this, even though First Nations are allowed to do it, that it's their right to do it, there's still a reaction against them doing this.
So that's a fairly substantial change in parks management as a result of the inclusion of these Aboriginal rights in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. How else has the management of Desolation Sound Marine Provincial Park in British Columbia changed in recent years?
That's another good question. BC Parks has been trying to sort of change its image to be more, I guess, First Nations friendly, I guess, or First Nations inclusive, because it did receive a lot of criticism from the First Nations there.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of coinciding with this treaty process, BC Parks kind of recognized that they would have to change the relationship with First Nations. So really in the last 15 years, they've been trying to get more First Nations, including people like the Tsleil-Waututh, on parks management roundtables, involved in policy creation. The Tsleil-Waututh also specifically developed a park warden training program with BC Parks. So essentially there would be a few local Tsleil-Waututh individuals that would be trained to monitor and to manage Desolation Sound Marine Park and the other parks in the area. Unfortunately, this sort of endeavor fell through when the two people hired to do it, one was injured and one took a different job. And then after that, the funding wasn't renewed, so this program kind of ended. But at least it was attempted. They've tried to do some other things as well. The Tsleil-Waututh specifically have actually bid on parks in order to operate them under the Liberals' downsizing program in the early 2000s. So they would actually run the park. And so they did this for a number of years, but found out that, of course, parks aren't that profitable. So they were actually running the park in the red. And this has kind of been a source of contention amongst the Tsleil-Waututh themselves. Some people continue to want to do this, even though it's kind of going to run them a deficit. They see it as kind of important that they can at least control this area in some way. But others, of course, suggest that if you can't make money off of it, and if you're going to have to run a deficit, then it's sort of counterproductive to do this. One of the other things that BC Parks has been sort of trying to do, or trying to do as much as the funding they have, is to protect all the archaeological sites in the park, which is hugely important to the Tsleil-Waututh. I should have mentioned before, in your last question, that one of the huge impacts that tourists and increased use has had on this area is the destruction of archaeological sites. Either consciously, people have gone out and found grave sites and other sites like this and robbed these graves or taken away sort of quote Indian artifacts, and then unconsciously as well, there's a lot of kayakers in the area, campers as well, that sort of pick spots to camp or to pull up their canoes without realizing that these are sort of ancient canoe runs that are getting damaged every time you drag a canoe up them, or ancient village sites that are getting damaged when you pound your tent stakes and things like that.
And this is a really fascinating aspect of this case study, and I think perhaps something that isn't very well explored in park history is the impact on archaeological sites in North American national and provincial parks and state parks, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I think.
So thinking more broadly then about your dissertation project, what does this case study reveal to you about the historical relationship between environmentalism or environmental thought and Aboriginal peoples in North America?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my broader dissertation is sort of using a few case studies in Western Canada and the Western United States to look at the various ways in which environmentalists, broadly defined, include things like conservationists and preservationists and that whole spectrum, how these people have interacted with Native Americans and First Nations. And what I'm finding is that it's really quite complex. It's really hard. I've been trying to come up with sort of one single driving thesis. I don't know if that's even possible on this, and I don't know if that's a problem either. I think it's okay. These relationships in general have really fluctuated depending upon their location, depending on the periods of time that you're looking at. So it fluctuates between greater collaboration, greater exclusion, things like this. So there isn't really a progressive line or anything like that. It's not progressive history that we can look at. But maybe the broader trends that I can talk about, the broader sort of revelations that we get when looking at these relationships between environmentalism or environmental thought and Aboriginal people. One, I think we have to increasingly focus not just on how Aboriginal people have interacted with environmentalists, sort of popular environmentalists per se, but to look at the myriad different ways in which environmental thought is developed amongst, say, government agencies, against provincial with provincial governments, with municipal governments, and then as well as sort of local conservationist groups or local recreation groups. These are all ways that environmental thought is kind of permeating the relationship between themselves and between the First Nations. So we really need to look at all these kind of aspects. I originally went into my dissertation thinking I would just look at environmentalist movements and Aboriginal people, and I found out that that wasn't always the most important relationship that they had with environmentalists, per se. So there's all these levels that we have to look at.
So in your research, you're finding a great deal of complexity, both related to geography and temporal specificity in the case of trying to understand Aboriginal people's relationship to environmentalism. Are you finding a similar kind of diversity in environmental thought among non-Aboriginal environmentalists in your different case studies?
Yeah, absolutely. The same thing. It depends on the time and the place and the individual lot as well. In some cases, environmentalist groups have been really careful about sort of working with First Nations and trying to be inclusive of them. In other cases, though, environmentalists have either paid just lip service to First Nations or to Native Americans, suggesting that sort of holding them up as these ecological Indians, but when the opportunity comes to allow them to be more active, sort of in controlling the land, they sort of backtrack and don't want to let go of their control that they have. Quite often it's simply a matter of sort of ignorance or just not knowing sort of the history of the place, and also buying into this whole wilderness ideology or pristine myth that the land wasn't really inhabited by anybody, or it was always wild, when that quite isn't the case.
Well, John, thanks for telling us a little bit more about your research and telling us a little bit more about Desolation Sound.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Sean. It was great.
National parks occupy a prominent place in the historiography of North American conservation and environmentalism. The histories of parks like Yellowstone and Banff National Parks are prominent in both Canadian and U.S. history and occupy a good deal of scholarly attention. Yet, provincial, state, and local parks in combination rival the acreage of the national park systems in North America. The histories of these parks, while somewhat understudied, can offer insights that can add nuance to our understanding of the development of conservation and nature protection in both Canada and the United States. The University of Saskatchewan recently hosted a symposium on historical perspectives on local and regional parks to try and bring attention to this aspect of North American parks and conservation history. I sat down with some of the participants of this symposium to discuss some of the main themes and ideas surrounding local and regional parks history.
Thanks for having me. My name is Steve Alexander, and I'm a doctoral student at Antioch University, New England, and an adjunct instructor at St. Lawrence University, and glad to be here.
Hi, my name is John Clapperton. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Saskatchewan in the Department of History.
Hello, I am Constanza Parra. I am a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Luxembourg.
Well, thanks for joining me today, everybody. We've just completed a two-day symposium on local and regional parks, and I wanted to get some of your thoughts on what you heard in terms of the papers that were presented at this symposium, and to really ask the question, why study local and regional parks? What is the significance of these parks to understanding environmental history and park history? Maybe if Steve wants to start us off.
Sure. One of the things that was really amazing that came out in looking at these variety of case studies that people brought from all over Canada and even internationally that were at a variety of scales and various jurisdictions was some really interesting themes and crossovers. Everything from common themes of resource use having to do with logging and forestry use in urban areas, both in Quebec and in France, to issues of accessibility and proximity.
So, John, you were involved in organizing this symposium, and I think you made a pretty strong case that park history is very overwhelmingly focused on national parks. What do these local and regional parks tell us about the history of parks?
Yeah, well, as you were mentioning, about half the parks in Canada aren't national, at least half of what we could find, what Keith Carlson and I could find. And I think that more people are affected by regional and provincial parks, or local and provincial parks, than they are even by national parks. So I think they're important on, I guess, the human or the social scale. But because they also take up so much space, they're also really important on the ecological scale. So these are, I guess, protected areas, if we can put that in quotes, right, of places all across Canada in many different ecological zones, and just very diverse places that don't get enough attention, and attention that I think is really deserved.
And Constanza, you had some really interesting observations on regional parks in Canada. You're bringing a perspective from French regional parks, but you found the system of provincial parks in Canada to be difficult to understand.
Yes, very, very difficult to understand. In fact, I am very interested in the sociality or socio-institutional aspects behind or from which parks are built up. I studied that for the French case, and I was very interested to get to know more about the Canadian situation, and I just discovered that the models of nature protection or parks are very, very varied here in Canada, and varied in every province, in every region.
Sure, and that seemed common in a lot of the papers. Does anybody want to pick up on that idea about the complexity of regulation or jurisdictional control?
If you wanted to go ahead, especially in Ottawa.
It's a very interesting theme that emerged, because when you, in many regards, when you're talking about these local and regional parks, you're getting a lot more individuals from that area who are becoming invested or who are coming into conflict. And so you have a variety of agents and actors who come into and fold into the story. And so the number of jurisdictions, therefore, becomes a lot more complicated as well.
Sure, and in the case you looked at Gatineau Park, do you want to explain a little bit about the jurisdictional complexities of understanding Gatineau Park?
Gatineau Park is a great example. It really fits into a category in and of itself, or you can't categorize it. It's neither a national park nor is it a provincial park. It is administered by the federal government, but it falls under the NCC, the National Capital Commission, and it sits on its own in and of itself. No other park in Canada has the same jurisdictional framework. And so while it's a regional park, it's and kind of local to the Ottawa area, it's embodying a national image at the same time.
So Constanza, how does that layer of jurisdiction compare to the regional parks in France? How are those parks administered?
In France, it is very interesting because regional parks were created in the early 70s as decentralization experiments. And today, when in a context where decentralization has been deepened, we found a lot of subnational institutions that with similar missions that today are fragmenting regional parks. Therefore, they are putting into question the mission and role of these institutions. And they have created a sort of institutional disorder or mess that goes against the sustainability of these territories.
And do we feel that the jurisdictional complexity of these local and regional parks has shaped the environment of these parks differently than perhaps the way in which we might understand the development in the history of national parks?
I guess yes, but all of the same, this is not really a problem because these are protected areas or parks that do not have the same missions that those of national parks. So to a certain extent, perhaps this is not a problem, or this is perhaps just a contemporary challenge of these territories.
In some regards, I wonder, though, it seems that they become much more dynamic in how they're envisioned and how they change over time. Because of the intersection of various jurisdictions, you have a variety of missions or ideas of what the space should be, as compared to this overarching national park theme where you have a central mission and vision of what a national park is that guides all of them. And so you have a much more kind of complicated and nuanced narrative for each of these individual parks, whether they're regional or local or provincial.
And I think we saw a really diverse range of parks. As examples, we had everything from very small city parks, square block parks, all the way to more traditional mountain parks like Garibaldi.
Sure. I think just both of these questions, that what we found was it was often local control or local people's interests that had more of a role in shaping the park and its environment than perhaps in national parks where it's often non-local people that are proposing for the park to be established and then controlling it thereafter. Whereas these provincial and local parks, of course, are controlled and run quite often anyways, not all the time, but quite often by the local people themselves. And so those parks are sort of put into a sphere where they're supposed to fit that local ideology or those local perceptions of what the environment should be. Such as Stanley Park, for example, as you did, Sean.
Right.
Or Desolation Sound Park, which I did.
So geography, historical geography is really important, I think, to the stories that everyone brought to this symposium, and proximity seemed to play a role, especially in use. I think we saw a lot of cases of parks' histories being affected by use from local people to some extent.
Gatineau Park is a great example. You know, one of the narratives that often emerges is that you have this park that was on the footsteps of the Capitol and could be considered, you know, the political playground. Often elicits this this vision of the view from Parliament Hill over across the Ottawa River out onto the Gatineau Hills, and really embodies this idea that this was a place for those who lived in the city to escape, to recreate, or to have a summer cottage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in some ways I think they, by creating that park, it intensifies their use just by drawing in visitors, although in some cases as well it reduces other uses. So for example, Gatineau Park, you don't have the resource extraction that you would have before, and things like this. So definitely use becomes an incredibly important aspect of them.
Going back to your question about the relevance of historical geography, I think these parks are very, very interesting from this point of view, because they are sort of places where different scales meet, temporal scales meet and intersect, temporal scales, territorial, institutional, political, administrative, etc.
Now, I think something that we didn't talk about too much in the symposium was the similarities between national parks and regional and local parks, that a lot of the histories of the national parks movement focus on the relationship between nature and the nation, or the relationship between colonial authority and Aboriginal people. But I think we found in a lot of these case studies that those same themes and those same issues can be explored in a local context. We talk a little bit about the nation. I mean, Gatineau Park obviously was one that embodied that, and we had a paper that dealt with the urban parks of Ottawa as well.
Yeah, Gatineau Park is a great example. You know, the idea was coming around at the turn of the century, and as we came up into the 1920s and 1930s, there was really this push to make Ottawa this Washington of the North, and Canada was looking to really identify itself, to separate itself from being a former British colony, really wanted to create its own identity. And as part of that, it really wanted a strong capital and a strong capital identity. And simultaneously, what's so interesting is in the creation of Gatineau Park, this was coming around when you had the emergence of this national park culture that was happening largely out in the West, but you saw the reflection of that in the design of Gatineau Park and these classic parkways in which the park was actually meant to be explored via an automobile.
Right. Yeah, I found also interesting about Gatineau Park, to switch the colonial question, as we discussed earlier, the fact that it's often upper middle class, Anglo male, or not males, but Anglo, I guess, elite that are living there. And then it was often the lower class French males that had to work afterwards. So this idea of colonialism within Canada between the French and the English, and then also we have the question of colonialism in Canada more typically seen between First Nations and European newcomers.
Mm-hmm.
So issues that Keith and I both looked at in BC, myself with Desolation Sound Marine Park on the West Coast, and Keith looking at maybe more urban viewscapes, what he called.
Mm-hmm. Keith Carlson presented a really interesting paper on proposals for different kinds of regional parks in the lower mainland of British Columbia in the Fraser Valley that drew from the spirituality of local indigenous peoples there. And it pointed to the ways in which regional parks and national parks in Canadian and U.S. history have also been built on recognizing special spiritually significant places, but in ways that don't have nearly the same kind of temporal depth as the connections of the Stalo people to the landscape of the Fraser Valley, which I thought was a really an interesting way of reinterpreting the meaning of local when we think about these kinds of places. Do we see any other similarities between these parks and the national parks movement? Are they being informed by the development of national parks in any ways, or do they inform the development of national parks?
In the case of France, they are tightly connected. In France, they created national parks, but then a few years later, they realized that the French territory was not suitable for building national parks all around, because France was populated. There was a rural population installed all over the country, so it was not possible to create an area without people. So they created, the French government, the French state created what they say in their words, a more suitable institution for this country, and they create regional parks that are inhabited territories, but that embodied more fragile ecosystems and a cultural heritage that needs to be preserved.
So do you feel like the national parks movement in France reflected too many of the American values of protecting uninhabited wilderness?
Yes, in fact, what they wanted to do in Europe was to build parks as it was done in North America, the model of Yellowstone and the first parks in Canada are pointed up as models all over the world. Even in Chile, all the creation followed the creation of the first parks in North America. Then they realized that they couldn't do it in the case of France, so they adapted and created a parc à la française, as they say.
Interestingly enough, Costanza, one of the things that I think regional parks in France have in similar with national parks in Canada, as well as regional and local parks in Canada, is this whole theme that we discussed about economic development, about parks being a new possibility or a new opportunity to create jobs and to create employment. And of course, Canada's first national parks, Banff and things like that, were specifically about economic development and bringing in money. And then I think almost all the parks that we looked at as well, the regional parks, were at least partially about economic development as much as they were about protecting certain ideals of wilderness or ideals of nature.
That's right. Jeff Slack presented a paper on the designation of Garibaldi Provincial Park in British Columbia and the role of tourism and the economic value of tourism in this region was a very prominent part of the creation of Garibaldi Provincial Park in the 1920s. Yeah. It's certainly a common theme in the national parks movement. I think there were some ways in which we can study local and regional parks to understand the national parks a little bit better as well. There were a number of cases of local and regional parks that were put forth as potential national parks, but were rejected for a number of reasons or were withdrawn. In the case of Dinosaur Provincial Park in Alberta. And it revealed, I think, a concurrent tension in between the development of provincial parks and the national park systems in Canada. And I understand a similar phenomenon occurred in the United States with state parks. But did we see these regional parks and local parks as lesser parks to the national parks? Are they the smaller versions of national parks?
I think once you get into the narratives themselves, they play a different story. They're in people's lives on a much more daily basis. And individuals are shaping the parks and being shaped by them on a much more consistent basis than when you think about these national parks that individuals may only go to once a year on a pilgrimage or maybe once in their lifetime to visit some of these national parks.
Sure, yeah. But I don't think that reality is reflected in the historiography that we have, which is really amazing that it's been so long. And yet we still don't have a huge body of literature on regional parks anywhere or on provincial parks. The national parks seem to be this icon of sort of Canadian identity that everyone holds up. We also talked about a little bit, though, how because national parks are so, because it's a federal thing across Canada, it's easier to research in some ways because you can sort of create a larger narrative, whereas there's so many particular differences amongst all the provincial and regional parks that it's just impossible to do that.
Sure, it's a really fragmented history. The history just of provincial parks in Canada is incredibly complicated because of all of the different provincial jurisdictions, and those histories are so diverse from province to province. We had a case study of Garibaldi as an early 20th century provincial park in British Columbia, and then a case study of Dinosaur Provincial Park in Alberta in the late 20th century, representing quite different histories of regional park development in these two neighboring provinces to one another. In what ways did landscape inform the creation of some of the parks that we looked at? And again, is there sort of local specificity here that different values are being expressed by local peoples and representing parks in ways that perhaps national parks don't embody those local values?
I really believe that the geography of these territories that we are looking at has a very, very direct impact in the sociality of these parks in this park, and I believe that the difference of the different models in each province in Canada is really related to the geography to which we are talking about. In the case of the Morvan, this is an outcrop, so it was a territory that we couldn't cross. It was a territory that served for hiding people. It was something mysterious, surrounded by a flat area. Therefore, it was somehow an isolated area. So we needed to give an institutional coherence to approach it to Paris, to approach it to the region. So that's why they create an institution.
Did you find something similar in the case of Desolation Sound Provincial Park?
Yeah, absolutely. The people that wanted to push for the park originally were yachters, and because Desolation Sound has extremely deep waters and then sort of juts against mountains, essentially shooting right out of the waterscape there, it was seen as an ideal paradise for yachters to come to, especially because in the early, in its early history anyway, you could get away from people, so you could feel almost isolated. It sort of embodied its name, Desolation Sound. So certainly landscape informed the desire for a park there.
That's very interesting because the Morvan Park was built to overcome isolation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So I think the topic of local and regional parks is pretty important, and obviously the folks who presented papers here at this symposium agree. I'm encouraged to see a little bit more focus on parks outside of the National Parks Framework. And I want to thank all of you for sharing some of your thoughts and your ideas on this symposium.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Yeah. Thank you.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Jonathan Clapperton, Constanza Parra, Steve Alexander, and me, Sean Karaj. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast and rate this podcast and write a short review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. If you have ideas for new episodes or you want to send me some feedback, you can contact me through my website at seancourage.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history research community from the Niche website at niche-canada.org, and you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next month with another episode of Nature's Past.